Did you know that over 60,000 new tracks are uploaded to Spotify every single day? That's a new track every 1.4 seconds, and that's just on one platform. With so much music now available, it's more important than ever to stand out from the crowd. So it's not surprising that more artists are starting to use less conventional sonic textures in their music, like field recordings. Perhaps you've always wanted to infuse the sounds of nature or your favourite city into your own tracks, but not having the right gear or knowledge might have held you back. Well, if that's the case, you're going to love the brand new guide I just created teaching you how to start field recording with just a smartphone, and it's all yours for free at femalediymusician.com/learnwithisabel. Yep, you really do just need a humble smartphone and some minimal extra gear that doesn't have to break the bank to get started with field recording. And I've laid it all out in this handy 5-point checklist. So download it for free at femalediymusician.com/learnwithisabel and elevate your music to the next level.
The thing that has helped me most in my career has been working with the good people. Essentially, you know, working with people who understand that I'm disabled and understand that I may not be able to do things that non-disabled people can do. So if you have the choice in your career, try to work with those kinds of people, because it will make your life so much easier to work with people who understand than to try and constantly fight against people who don't understand.
Hello and welcome to Girls Twiddling Knobs. My name's Isabel, and over the last decade, my self-produced and self-released music has amassed over 25 million Spotify streams. I also have a PhD in sonic arts, but I wasn't always this confident with music tech. In fact, I still hear those self-doubt gremlins in my head from time to time. I started this podcast to help more female-identifying musicians start recording and producing their music and learn from other women making music with technology. If that's your cup of tea, then you're in the right place, my friend. Let's dive in. Well, hello, Knob Twiddlers, and welcome back to another episode of Girls Twiddling Knobs. And today on the podcast, we're covering a really important topic and one that's close to my heart, navigating a freelance career as a musician. And it's close to my heart because I've gone through many years of having debilitating chronic pain that severely impacted my ability to do normal activities like washing and cooking, let alone making and performing music. And while I'm doing much better now health-wise, I know I'll always have to factor my physical health into most professional decisions I make, not to mention my mental health, of course, and that I'm only ever, as we all are, temporarily able. I will also never forget just how impossible having a chronic illness and disability made the whole experience of performing music as well. And this is another reason why I'm so passionate about advocating the ability to record and produce yourself from home, because it opens up so many more flexible ways of making music and an income as an artist. And therefore, I wanted to do an episode just on how you can navigate a career as a disabled musician and the challenges this might entail. And I'm thrilled to be joined by guest Meg Fozzard to do exactly that, because as well as Meg being a disabled freelance artist, she's also an activist and a journalist campaigning for change and better support for disabled people in the creative industries. And Meg isn't a musician and doesn't work in audio, but she is so articulate and knowledgeable about the experiences many disabled artists have. And you'll hear that inside this episode, she gives really practical advice if you're a disabled artist yourself. We talk about things like access riders, communicating your needs, and the tension this can bring up, as well as how Meg became disabled just after she graduated university and was about to embark on a creative career. So if you're living with a disability, you'll get so much out of this episode, but I also really hope you'll keep listening if you're not disabled, or as I would say, if you're temporarily able, because none of us are invulnerable. Bodies, minds, and brains are constantly in flux, and we all need to work towards a more inclusive and fair music industry for disabled artists. Okay, let's meet Meg. So thank you so much, Meg, for joining me on Girls Twiddling Knobs.
No worries, I'm really happy to be here.
Me too. And I think it's really nice because you're coming from a slightly different kind of field in the arts, which is always lovely to have different perspectives on the podcast. But also because we're specifically going to talk about navigating a creative career as a disabled artist and freelancer. And I know that lots of people listening to this podcast will find that really useful, not just in terms of if they are disabled themselves. And of course, that means many different things to different people, but also in terms of supporting their colleagues and their peers too.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm really, really glad that we're having this conversation. But first, what I would like to ask you is, I'd love for you to tell us what it is that you do.
Hi, I'm Meg. I am a disabled freelance producer. I tend to not focus on one kind of platform. So I've worked on AR, VR, social media, video, theatre, but the thread throughout my work tends to be disability. So unlike other producers who may, say, work only in film or only in TV or only on games or only on music, I tend to work across all different kinds of platforms and genres, but the focus tends to be on disability.
Yeah, so I think this is a really nice kind of expanded use of the word producer in the context of this podcast, because on Girls Twiddling Knobs, we're usually talking about music production. We're talking about, you know, the person that pulls the recording together and has the vision for how it's going to sound when it's finished and people are listening to it. But you're talking about being a producer in a much more expanded term of having a role where you kind of make things, and those things could be podcasts, those things could be theatre productions, those things could be VR experiences. So I think that's a really creative kind of springboard for us.
Oh, great. Yeah. I mean, I would say I've had like quite a varied career, and it was not the career that I was expecting to have, to be honest with you, because basically I graduated from film school in 2019 and I've been studying creative producing for digital platforms at the National Film and Television School, and there I learned to produce all the things I just described to you, and I was really, you know, really excited to start my career. I'd have to be just started working for a charity and making content for them. And then I became disabled very shortly after graduating. So I think I graduated in February and I became disabled in April. So I didn't have much of a chance really to get started on my career in the way that I intended. So I very much like had to kind of go back to the drawing board and think about what I am capable of doing nowadays, and I've really had to change the way that I work, which I think people listening would be really interested to hear.
Definitely. But before we get into that, I would really like to come back to, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, firstly, I think just to kind of acknowledge that disability is not something that is just fixed. That, you know, as you described, you finished your degree in February, and then by April you'd become disabled. Yeah. And I think that a lot of the time in society, we see it almost as being quite static. You either are disabled and you were born with something, you know, that means you're disabled, or you're not. You're a kind of a normal person or able-bodied person or whatever that is. And it's so, so naive of any of us to see our physical and mental state as being that fixed, you know?
Yeah, and I think like, disability is definitely very fluid, and I mean, I don't want to scare anyone listening to this, but literally anyone can become disabled at any time. You know, your career is not guaranteed, your health is definitely not guaranteed. That's something that I learned from becoming disabled, so I don't want to make everyone too scared or anything, but you know, you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. So you might be planning your career as an able-bodied or non-disabled person, but always plan for the worst, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that I totally get what you're saying, Meg. You don't want to kind of scaremonger people into thinking, oh my God, you know, I could become disabled tomorrow or whatever that might be. But at the same time, I think it's really important to be just a little bit more grown up about this. And to take responsibility for the fact that we are in bodies and minds that are ever changing. And therefore, even if we're not currently affected by these issues of disability, that we could be at any moment, and that therefore we really have to take care of each other and have respect for each other, because it's not something that happens just to other people. All of us are vulnerable as humans.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And I feel like things like having rest periods, you know, are so important to anyone in a career, regardless of whether or not you're disabled. So I really stress people to learn how to do nothing, basically, you know, be really comfortable in knowing how to rest properly. And that might sound really silly, but I find it really important.
Yeah, because I think that this culture that is almost in denial about the fact that we are vulnerable, ever-changing, messy bodies and minds.
Yeah.
This culture that treats everyone as if they're constantly supposed to be on and able to be on all the time breeds a lot of disability. You know, it breeds a lot of issues that come from that. So I totally hear what you're saying.
Yeah, it's exhausting, this kind of hustle culture that we live in nowadays. I mean, I remember when I was at film school being told that all my side hobbies, like, they should become products and they should be monetized. And I was like, well, I don't really want to have to monetize everything in my life. Like, I have to keep some things that are just for me. But the idea that we constantly have to be hustling and making money, and I don't know, I think it's very damaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so now I'd like to come back to that time for you where you'd graduated. So everyone that's done a degree listening, I know not everyone will have done a degree listening, but if you have, then you can probably all relate to that feeling where you graduate, you're kind of exhausted because most people probably work pretty hard to turn in their final projects and all their final exams or whatever. You come out the other side and then you have this feeling of like, oh, is that it? Oh my God. And then the panic sets in. But for you, you had an even more confusing, scary experience of graduating. So are you happy to tell us about what that felt like becoming disabled at that time for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like even before I became disabled, when I graduated from film school, there was definitely this feeling, oh shit, like, because I had the same when I graduated from my undergrad, like, because I very naively assumed that I would graduate and get the job of my dreams, and guess what, I didn't. So I was already in that oh shit period when I became disabled, because you know, I was already in that my life is not going to go the way I planned. And then they went even more not the way I planned. So, it was, I don't think there's ever a good time to become disabled, but right after you graduate is probably not the one.
No, and I think it is really hard if you're young. And I think it's hard when you're in that phase of your life where you're trying to build your career up. You're trying to, you know, maybe like thinking about meeting a partner, all of those things. And it's something that's never written into the narrative in our culture. It's just presumed that you're going to, you know, you're going to be able to do all those things exactly how they show in the films.
Yes.
But then you find yourself, I mean, I have a different experience of disability. I've lived with chronic pain for a long time and long periods where I just couldn't do totally normal things that meant dating. Just out of the question, you know, and then you'd have to kind of find ways to do that. And you're always finding ways, I think, as someone who's affected by disability and chronic illness, you're very creative because you have to always find ways around, you know, getting around the barriers, basically. So I'm not saying that, like, I just couldn't do things and that was it, but it was exhausting having to think, right, how do I do these really normal things that all of my friends are taking for granted? And how do I accept myself not doing all the things that my friends are doing and taking for granted? How do I have that self-worth when my friends are meeting partners, my friends are building up their income, they are building up their career, and I'm right now able to, for example, sit on a couch and breathe, and I have to find value as a human in just being able to do that? Can you speak to that, Meg?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so when I became disabled, it was the summertime, springtime, and I was really excited for that summer. It was one of my first summers in London, and it was my first summer not as a student, so I thought I was going to have money finally to get up to some summer hijinks. And even just being in the hospital in that summer, and I'm very, very lucky with my friends because I think, unlike a lot of disabled people, my friends have been amazing throughout this and they have stuck by me 100%.
That's
and
awesome.
I've never had any issues with my friends. But even just being in the hospital beds and saying bye to them over an evening and thinking, you get to go to the pub now.
Yeah.
I can't go. And it's just like very little things like that. Also, I had a ticket to go to Glastonbury that year. And obviously could not go. I was on a high dependency unit. There's no way I was going to go to Glastonbury. Just watching it on the TV in the hospital bed thinking, this is not where I thought my life would be right now. But yeah, if you're physically incapable of doing something, you can't. But then there's always going to be FOMO, isn't there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that for me, I felt a great deal of shame as well, which seems ridiculous. But, you know, when you think about it from a distance, that's crazy. But I felt a lot of shame that I couldn't join in and that I couldn't just be normal, you know, and I couldn't kind of keep up in a normal way. Yeah. And that for me to do certain things would mean having to then really rest for days afterwards or kind of accepting that was all my energy or my kind of pain threshold used up. And it's stuff that other people just weren't having to think about. So I felt a lot of shame about that.
Yeah, yeah. It's so difficult, isn't it? I mean, I remember feeling, I don't know if shame is the right word, but like just pressure, you know, pressure to, and I still feel it nowadays, you know, I've been disabled for over 4 years now and the pressure to be the way that I used to be, even though that's never going to happen, you know. I was with a friend last night talking about maybe trying to get Glastonbury tickets for next year and thinking, I'm not going to be the same at Glastonbury as I've been in previous years because, first of all, I'm a wheelchair user. It's really difficult to get around. But second of all, I'm tired, you know. He was saying how they had a really early night one night and went to bed at 1, and I sat there thinking, Jesus Christ, 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
1 o'clock is late for me nowadays.
Me too, yeah. Definitely. Fuck 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like I'm really pushing the boat out there. But I wondered, would you mind telling us, I don't want you to kind of relive anything that's like difficult for you, Meg, but if you could tell us, what is it that you now deal with in terms of symptoms and, you know, what is your disability? How does it affect you?
Sure. So I have something called a hypoxic brain injury. It's essentially damage to my brain. And I've also got a heart condition called ARVC. Do not ask me what it stands for because I can never remember. So this means that I am an ambulatory wheelchair user, so I can stand for short periods of time and I can walk maybe a couple of steps. And those are like the physical things that I face, and they're things that people look at me and clearly see a disabled person in the wheelchair. But with my brain injury, there's a lot of stuff happening in my noggin that is not quite working correctly. So I get really bad fatigue. I have short-term memory loss, which is probably one of the most frustrating things that I face. I have a condition called dystonia, which means that I have tremors. I have difficulty picking up small objects and issues with my dexterity. So yeah, I mean, I'm very clearly physically disabled, but there's lots of stuff going on in my head that makes it even more challenging. And as a result of becoming disabled, my anxiety levels have increased so much just because of all the challenges I face in life day to day because I'm a disabled person.
Yeah, and I think you really articulate that really well, that, you know, it's not just what somebody might see. It's all of the layers that go on because you've got all of those kind of neurological things going on as well for you, Meg, but then it's the psychological impact of both the physical and the neurological things is just as debilitating, you know, just in a different way.
And people talk about hidden or invisible disabilities, which are disabilities you can't obviously see. But I was reading something recently that said, well, they're not really hidden. You know, if you are that person, you know it's not hidden because you see the way it affects you and the people close to you see the way it affects you. So I don't think any disability is truly hidden.
Yeah, and it's possibly just that society's just ignorant to it. And that's why it thinks that it's hidden. But like you say, for the person experiencing it and their loved ones as well, it's obvious, you know. Well, so what I would love to know is how you think that your disability has then impacted the work that you've gone into and the way that you work, Meg.
Mm. Well, first off, I work part-time. I work 3 days a week. And if I do any more than that, I take extra rest days to compensate. Like, for example, I just started a new job this week. And
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited. Just mainly the fatigue is the thing that gets me the most in the working environment. Like, just working for that long tired me out so much. Yeah, other issues I face in, like, the job world is obviously short-term memory loss. People would assume that means that I'm not very good at being organised. I actually find it works in the opposite way. So if somebody tells me something, I have to write it down immediately. And I have to be so super organised to kind of compensate for the fact that my memory is not great. So, yeah, I found, you know, ways around it that help me out in the workplace for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point as well, that I think that if you have some kind of disability, and it made me think of the fact that as someone who's dyslexic, so I have terrible short-term memory, and I really need to see things mapped out to really get my head around them. I think it's meant that I'm very visual, and it means that I've become very organized to counteract it. And sometimes people will kind of say, oh my God, you're so organized, like you're so type A. And I probably am type A, but I'm also dyslexic. And it's like, if I didn't do this, I'd be an absolute fucking mess. So like, if I'm gonna get anything done, so it just tips the other way where you're like, right, well, and I love all the charts, I love the visuals, I love, you know, it just helps me retain it and make sense of it. So I think that's a really good point, that these changes or just these kind of different ways of being can mean that you're actually really organized, or, you know, you're really effective because you have to be. It's not a choice for you. It's not like, oh, I should get more organized. It's like, if I don't, nothing's going to happen.
Literally, nobody will employ me. I'm fired, you know?
Yeah.
It's always a good motivator, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But then I think that plays into what we're talking about with energy, because it's more energy as well. Like, you having to write everything down, you having to keep track of things. It's like double the work, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that often doesn't get noticed. And then that kind of ties in with you needing more rest, you know, that part of that must be that you're also having to really make an effort while you're on the job to be, you know, taking notes and making sure that you've got everything in the right place and you've remembered everything, and, you know.
It can be exhausting, and, you know, even just talking about it now is making me feel tired.
Sorry.
I'm like, oh God, exhausting.
But what I would love to kind of get a sense of is, we've had a little window into how, you know, your disability might impact the work that you do, but also it seems like it's helped you to be really boundaried in a really positive way, though, in a way that maybe you would have found hard otherwise, because you have to be like super aware of your energy levels and therefore book time off to make, you know, to kind of retop your energy. It's all stuff that people don't usually do but it's actually really healthy. And I'm just wondering if there's people listening here who are disabled in, you know, the very, very vast number of ways that could be. I know that it could be lots of different things. What do you think are some key principles that help creatives, you know, working as a freelancer or just working in the creative industries, trying to navigate that career, which is, I think, even more kind of ableist than a lot of other fields, actually?
Yeah, I mean, I think The thing that has helped me most in my career has been working with the good people, essentially, you know, working with people who understand that I'm disabled and understand that I may not be able to do things that non-disabled people can do. So if you have the choice in your career, try to work with those kinds of people, because it will make your life so much easier to work with people who understand than to try and constantly fight against people who don't understand.
And can I just ask, Meg, what are some red flags? If there's anyone listening who's like, well, I'm only starting out, and how do I know if someone's going to be understanding and a good person to work with?
Sure. I mean, I can tell you a red flag that happened to me when I first became disabled. So I was employed and I said that I was going to work part-time, and they kept saying to me, oh, but, you know, when you're able to work full-time, you know, when you can do 5 days a week. And I was like, no, I can't. I know I can't. And I think they thought in their head that I was going to get better. But I know, like, I'm not going to get better now, you know. This is my maximum capacity. I think with a brain injury, your recovery period is 2 years for, like, you to make significant improvements. And I'm way, way past 2 years now. And that's not to say that little things in my life and my condition won't improve, but, like, the bulk of the improving is done. And I am probably never going to work full-time again. So to be kind of gaslit a little bit and said, oh, but when you're coming back full-time, it was very, very difficult, because you don't want to let people down as well. And I think that for me was a massive miscommunication with my employer, where it wasn't communicated to them properly that I'm now a part-time worker. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like finding people who really go by your lead in terms of what you're capable of doing, the kind of working routine you need, all that stuff. You'll get a sense if they're listening to that or if they're not getting it, and they're just kind of trying to control the narrative on that in a way. Yeah. Just kind of pigeonhole you back into normal hustle culture.
Yeah. And I mean, there are things you can do to help people understand. Like, for example, I now have a thing called an access rider. And it's a document which has my, like, medical definitions in it, like all my conditions listed. And it specifies, like, the amount of time that I can work, if I work more than that, the amount of time that I need to rest. Things like travel within London, because I live in Southeast London. So if I'm going, say, to Central, what I need to be put in place so I can do that. Travel in the UK, and I'm very pie in the sky here, and I've got international travel on my access rider, which has not happened yet. But I feel like if I put it there, maybe someday somebody will pay for me to, you know, fly to New York or something for a conference. But I have started sending that out to people I work with. So it's kind of like an unofficial, unlegal agreement of, okay, so now you know what I need from you to make sure I can work to my best abilities. I am kind of tempted to make people sign it. I'm sure it will have no legal standing whatsoever, but maybe like something on the bottom to say, yes, I have read and I understand this sort of document. But yeah, I found since sending that out to people, my anxiety about what people expect of me has just diminished so much, because I know what they expect of me, and they know how the ways in which I work. So, yeah. If you are a disabled person listening to this, I cannot recommend enough writing an access rider.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good tip. If there's one thing that I hope people take away from this conversation, it's the access rider thing, because I do want to talk about the complexities of it, because I know there'll be people listening be like, oh, that sounds a bit scary sending that off.
It is, you know, it is. And the list of my medical descriptions, it's a bit it's not information that is lovely to share with people, shall we say, you know. It's not in massive detail, but it's not great information. And I did a workshop recently about working as a disabled creative, and we put it up, Max has read it up on the screen, and the whole audience was looking at it, and I was but you know, it was for the greater good, shall we say, because everyone learned a lot from that workshop. And so you have to kind of get past the hump of awkwardness and that, oh, everyone knows there's something wrong with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
To make your work life so much better.
Yeah, and I think the principle of, this is something that I'm still kind of learning, really, but the principle of communicating your needs and your boundaries first, before anyone crosses them or anyone does anything wrong, communicate it first. Mm-hmm. And then if you need to reinforce it, it feels so much less anxiety inducing because you're like, well, I said it at the beginning and you had it in writing. And, you know, therefore, it's totally fine for me to say, actually, remember, I can't do that. Or remember, if I do that, then I have to do this thing. You know, I think, can you give anyone tips on how you would put an access rider together, Meg? I'm thinking that, you know, you mentioned that you kind of divulged some of your medical conditions. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you don't have to do that, though, right?
No, you don't. You don't have to do anything. Yeah. I mean, it's entirely a document written by you. So you can put however much or however little in it. Mine also says at the top that it's a live document and that it might change at any point. Mm-hmm. Just so people are aware that disabilities can fluctuate. But no, you don't have to put anything in that you don't want to put in. So I had no idea about access riders until I think it was last year, and I was doing a course on how to work with neurodivergent and learning disabled artists. So it wasn't a course specifically aimed at me knowing how to do my own access rider, but it's talking about how to create them for other people. And during this course, I was like, shit, actually, I think I need one of these. So
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if they're commonplace. I don't know if everyone's aware about them, but they should be.
Yeah. And have you ever sent the access rider out and then come back with somebody saying, oh, actually, we're not going to take you for the job? Because that's probably what most people would be scared of.
I did. I had a situation recently where I had a second interview and I sent them my access rider before they said, yeah, you've got the job. And then I didn't get the job. And I slightly suspected it could have been because of the access rider, because it was a job with very, like, random hours.
Mm-hmm.
But then thinking about it now, would I rather take a job that wasn't right for me and just struggle through? So I'll never know whether or not it's because of the access rider or whether I just didn't get the job. But I mean, there's a good way to counteract that. And so what I've done in the past is say to people during the interview, like, by the way, I do have some access needs. And then send it after you've got the job, basically.
Yeah, so that's a good tip, to kind of send it after you've got the job. Because the thing is, and also if you said in the interview you have access needs, you've been up front, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good thing to be aware of. Well, I think that what I would kind of recommend people do listening to this is maybe look up access riders. I'm sure there's information out there on, you know, what they might look like.
Mm-hmm.
And to just remember that you only have to put what you want to in, and that it's a chance for you to just really clearly state what your needs are, what your limitations are, the kind of support you might need in certain circumstances. And, you know, I'm thinking for musicians, it will be things like getting into spaces, having help with lifting their equipment. It could be things to do with, you know, noise levels as well. So, yeah.
Things like breakout spaces as well, you know. Having time to rest whilst you're on job is really important for things I've done in the past, like theatre. in rehearsal rooms, or being in the rehearsal room and knowing there's a breakout space right there if I need to get out and just sit in the quiet room for 10 minutes, half an hour. Yeah.
Yeah. And so thinking about the creative industries more generally, Meg, where do you think we're getting it right with disability and access? And where do you think that we're still getting it wrong?
I think we're getting it right in the sense that representation is getting better. You nowadays do see more disabled people in the workplace, and you see more disabled people on TV screens, playing in bands, you know, on podcasts like this. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like representation is getting better. I don't think we're quite there yet where disabled people are in higher up in companies. So I think a lot of disabled people end up working very low level in companies. And that's something I definitely want to see change throughout my career. You know, I want to go up and up and up, and I want other disabled people to be in senior level positions. I mean, the majority of disabled people I know that do work are on my level, and I don't know of many people who are at a senior level. And I feel like it's at the senior level where decisions get made. And, you know, it's only fair that disabled people are involved in making those decisions.
Yeah. And when we were kind of preparing for this conversation, you told me about a project called Equal Two, where the actual team was genuinely diverse when it comes to disability, because you were mentioning how a lot of the time there's more work that's aimed at disabled audiences, but the actual team making it aren't necessarily very diverse. So could you tell us a bit about that project and what it was like working in that team?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a podcast called Equal to Achieving Disability Equality, and it came out during the Paralympics in 2021. I forget what year we're in now. The delayed coronavirus Paralympics. And it was a podcast that used the Paralympics as kind of a springboard to talk about other issues that affect disabled people. Things like transport, media, all kinds of areas. And that was one of the best teams I've ever worked on, because the production company said from the get-go, we are going to have 50% disabled people working across this, both like as guests on the podcast, but also behind the scenes. So obviously I was employed as a disabled freelance producer on that project, and I work with a team of fantastic disabled freelancers. All of them had different access needs, but it was really, really refreshing to work on a project about disability with actual disabled people involved. You know, I've worked on other projects that are not like that at all. And very often I'm the only disabled person in the room, and I'm thinking, Where are the others? You know, it can't be just me. I can't be the sole disabled voice on this project. So, yeah, that was a really, really refreshing workplace environment for sure.
And how do you think it impacted the actual output of the podcast? Like, could you see how that variety of experiences and that real life experience in the team of disability was then creating a podcast that had more of a, I don't know, a complex or nuanced or interesting take on disability?
I think it was great because as disabled freelancers, we all got it and we were all super, super passionate to be working on it. And I feel like a team of non-disabled freelancers maybe might not have been as passionate about it. Yeah, I mean, I hope it improved the podcast overall. I think it did quite well. So, yeah, I feel like if you're talking about a subject like disability, lived experience is so important, because without lived experience, it becomes less valid in my eyes. And I think this validated disabled community. I mean, I don't want to get too controversial here, but I know that Rosie Jones has got a new documentary out and it's got a slur in the title. So I won't repeat the title here.
Okay.
You can go and Google it. And I know there were members of the disabled community who were supposed to be involved in that documentary. And when they found out about the title, they withdrew their consent and withdrew from the documentary entirely. So in picking that title, they have removed the lived experience of many great disabled people who wanted to be involved in it.
Well, of course, listeners can go and look that up if they want to when this comes out. But I'm also kind of thinking about, you know how we talked about if someone's listening and they are disabled and they're trying to kind of navigate their career. What about if someone's listening and they're temporarily able-bodied?
Yeah.
Because we all are. Mm-hmm. They're temporarily able-bodied and they're thinking, how do I support my peers and my colleagues better who might be disabled? Or how do I put together a project where I do include more disabled people? How might they go about that, Meg?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone listening to this podcast, regardless of disability or not, should maybe familiarise themselves with what an access rider looks like. Just so you know, if one lands in your inbox, you're not going to be completely surprised by it. I think non-disabled people can be really, really great allies in the workplace, you know. I think they can help in so many ways. I think just engaging with what's happening in the disabled community and learning from your colleagues what they need is so important. And make sure if you say you're listening to people, you are actually listening to them and let them lead the way.
Yeah.
Let them be the voice. But yeah, I definitely want to see far more disabled people working in the cultural sector.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, if you are, for example, reaching out to people to collaborate, being someone that says, look, I'd love to collaborate, this is the project. And, you know, before we get started, is there any kind of support that you need so that you instigate that conversation?
Yes,
you're not always
expecting
somebody to come with, you know, here's my access rider, which is great if people have it. But to be someone that just is aware that even if somebody doesn't, you know, seems to appear able-bodied, even if that is the case, that just to start that conversation regardless is far more inclusive.
Yeah, and I think like this, again, this might be slightly controversial, but I think that everyone involved in the project should do an access rider.
Yeah.
Because everyone has access needs, regardless of whether or not they're aware of it. Like, yes, you might not be a wheelchair user, you might not need a ramp to get in the building, but do you have kids to pick up from school at 3:30? You know, that's an access need.
Yeah.
That's a need that you need to do to make sure you can do your job properly.
Totally.
I feel like everyone should do an access rider.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to just touch on, Meg, unless there's other things that you wanted to share, but I really wanted to get some more information about the access to work scheme that you mentioned, because I think that could be really practically useful right now for people listening if they're not aware of it. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. So the access to work is a government-run scheme where they will give you funding to help you do your job and to be better in the workplace. I'm not going to lie to you, it's not a fun or easy process. There are lots and lots of forms to fill out, but it does mean that you get support that you need. So like, for example, I have now got something called Otter AI, which takes meeting notes on my behalf because I can't type very well. And that has made my life so much easier. Also, they do stuff like getting to work. So for my new job, they've just upped my taxi provision so I can get a taxi once a week to work, which is so much better than trying to get on public transport in a wheelchair during rush hour. But there's many, many different ways that access to work can help you. For example, I know they help out neurodivergent people. And so you might think, oh, yeah, I don't know if I really need that. speak to them, honestly, because they can do far more than I can even describe. And it is a very long process, though. I think mine took 3 months to come through, from sending off the application to it finally being put in place. But it can make a real, real difference to your work life, and it makes stuff easier, and that's what we want.
Definitely. Yeah, well, we will put a link to the Access to Work scheme so anyone listening can go and find out more about that. Are there any other organisations that you think are really helpful for people working in the creative industries who are living with a disability?
Yes, so there is DANC, the Disabled Artists Network Community. They send out a newsletter twice a week. DPTV, Disabled and Deaf People Working in Television. There are, I think, multiple audio groups you can join. Yeah, I mean, I find groups via Twitter, Slack. There are definitely communities out there that can support you. It's just it's finding them that can be tricky sometimes.
Yeah, and I know that in music, there's Drake Music. That's a charity for disabled musicians. So I'll link to all of the ones that you mentioned there, Meg, and also Drake Music. And so if people are listening, they can go and find some resources as well.
Yeah, fabulous. But just try and find your people, you know. Try and find people working either in the same field or with a similar disability to you. And then you've kind of got your community, and that makes it so much easier when you want to have a rant in the main. You can rant to like-minded people.
And I guess that you can kind of find people that have maybe done things that you haven't done yet who are also disabled, and you can ask them, how did you do that? Or is there anything I should, you know, do if I want to do this thing? Is there anything you want to add, Meg, before we finish up?
So you can find me on pretty much every social media out there. I am at Meg Rosfoss, that's MEGROZFOZZ. I have a website which has all my previous work on it and the articles that I've written.
Awesome. Well, we'll put all the links to your social media and your website as well, Meg, so people can go and find out more. I'm sure people will really be interested to read some of your writing on these issues as well. So we will make sure those links are in the show notes.
Amazing.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been so good to chat about all of this and to hear a bit about your story. But I really do think there's lots of people listening to the podcast who this affects on a very significant level. And it will have been really helpful to listen to this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been brilliant.
Okay, I think you'll agree that this was probably one of the most important conversations we have had on the podcast yet. There's no doubt that disability comes in so many forms and encompasses so many different human experiences. What one disabled person might find challenging won't be an issue for another person with a different condition. You might not be a wheelchair user, for example, but perhaps you have a mental health condition. You may be affected by your disability every second of the day, or it may be something that ebbs and flows depending on various factors. But I think that Meg articulated really well the practical ways we could all help make the creative industries more inclusive and accessible for people with disabilities and everyone else in the process. And if you want to find out more about Meg, I've linked to her website in the show notes, and I've also linked to a wonderful charity called Drake Music, who work in the areas of disability, music and technology, and often advertise exciting opportunities for disabled artists. And I've also linked to the Access to Work scheme that Meg mentioned, and the Disabled Artist Networking Community also, so there's lots more to explore from here. Now, next week on the podcast, we're diving into a topic that's a little more technical and one of the number one questions I'm asked by people all the time. Which DAW is the right choice for you? And if you're thinking, what's a DAW? I'm talking about a digital audio workstation, which is basically a fancy word for your recording software. And with so many different brands now available for you to choose from, it can feel pretty overwhelming knowing which one you should go for. So in next week's episode, I'm breaking down the options for you out there right now, which one is best depending on your needs, and my personal top three favourite picks as well. But till then, take care, and I'll catch you here soon. Girls Twiddling Knobs is hosted and produced by me, Isabel Anderson, with production support from Jade Bailey. And this is a female DIY musician production. So, how do you like that episode, dear listener? If you loved it, and you know someone else who would love it too, be a good friend and share it with them. Go on, spread the Girls Twiddling Knobs love.